Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Sami Siddiqui. Today, I'm speaking to Professor Robert Tierney about Tropics of Savagery, The Culture of Japanese Empire in Comparative Frame. Tropics of Savagery was published by the University of California Press in 2010. Dr. Tierney is a professor of Japanese literature at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies, Dr. Tierney. So our first question is always biographical. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up and how did you become interested in Japanese literature?
Sure. I grew up in southern Massachusetts, near Fall River, and then lived in the Boston area, where I studied undergraduate. And I studied actually French literature in my undergraduate years. And then after that, I lived for some time in Japan and decided to go back to graduate school and study Japanese literature. So that's in a nutshell where I'm coming from. When I was in graduate school, I was doing Japanese literature, undergraduate French literature, which is one reason why I guess I'm a comparativist.
That makes complete sense in the way, how your trajectory took you to this book. That's great. Thank you so much. So could you tell us about the genesis of this project? What made you want to write this particular book?
Yes, it's a development of my doctoral dissertation, which I did at Stanford. I completed my degree in 2005, and I wrote the book the next few years after graduating when I was working at the University of Illinois. I guess the project has a older the beginning because I really came to this topic while I was a student in the graduate program at Stanford. And I took a course, I think the first year that I was at Stanford, on the Japanese Empire that was taught by Peter Deuce. That made me think that maybe what I wanted to do, my own research, was to look into the Japanese Empire and study its culture, study the literature that came out of it. I remember reading a comment, I think, by Marius Janson that the Japanese Empire produced no Kipling or produced, no great writers, no great cultural products came out of the empire. And I was interested in that statement, but I was also somewhat skeptical about it and thought that maybe simply this topic had never really been studied.
Great. Thank you so much. That's fascinating to hear that this came out of those sort of graduate classes. So now getting to the content of the book, could you begin by explaining what you mean by the title, Tropics of Savagery?
Yes.
And the subtitle, The Culture of Japanese Empire and Colonial Frame, as it gets to the heart of your book.
In Comparative Frame.
Yes.
Yes. The title, and both have a meaning, I think. Tropics of Savagery had to do with the identification of, especially in Western discourse, but even in Japanese discourse, of savagery with the tropics. So that was one reason for the topic. And of course, the word tropics has a kind of double meaning, and I'm using it in the sense that Hayden White refers to tropics of discourse, that in other words, tropes. Because actually what I'm looking at is tropes of savagery in addition to something that is sort of set generally in the tropics. The two places that I look at are sort of tropical. As far as the culture of Japanese empire in comparative frame, one of the ambitions, I think, of the book is to try to fit the Japanese empire, particularly not so much now, but at the time that I began my graduate study, was sort of overlooked in most international or global studies of world empire. And as I said, I think this has changed over the last couple of decades. But certainly when I was studying, it seemed as though the Japanese empire was a bit of an exception. It was studied sort of in isolation. And my attempt is to sort of fit Japan in a kind of comparative frame, Japan as a colonial power in comparison with, England, France, other countries, and to also fit Japan within, I think, a post-colonial theory, which primarily, the empirical cases upon which most of the theory is based are actually based only on the English Empire or perhaps the French. And so one of the things that I think I'm trying to do in this book is to, by putting it in a comparative frame, to also challenge some of the ideas in post-colonial theory to make it a post-colonial theorist had considered Japan instead of England as the paradigmatic case of empire. And it's one of the purposes of the book. And I think, this is also maybe other writers who've written about, let's say, the German Empire or the Spanish Empire have also, I think, recently started to question some of the theoretical constructs of post-colonial theory and to better situate their own field of study. This was one of the ambitions of my work.
Thank you. Now, sticking with sort of methodological questions, you discussed James Clifford's argument that every ethnography about another culture is also an allegory about the ethnographer's own culture. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about how you read allegory within, Japanese colonial literature as a way to understand Japanese imperial culture?
Yes. I think allegory comes up in many different ways in this topic, and part of it is when James Clifford is writing, he's also writing about the ethnographer, the writer about another culture, and so I would include myself in this as well. I mean, I wrote this book in 2010, but I did most of the research about a decade earlier. And of course, I was appalled by what was going on in the United States at that time, and particularly the invasion of Iraq. And it was frankly incomprehensible to me what was going on, but also this discourse about terror and which reminded me a little bit of savagery. So in some way, I think I was writing about myself in writing about this, using the Japanese case to understand my own situation as an American. But there's also, I think in the book, I talk about allegory. I talk about, for example, allegory as a way of saying something that cannot be said directly, saying it through a kind of coded language. And this would be, for example, the case of Sato Haruo's story about set in Taiwan, but actually most likely a kind of allegory about the recent massacre of Koreans during the Great Kanto earthquake. I guess that would be one use of allegory. Saying another one would be allegory as a kind of something like a Momotaro, which could have several different meanings. And this would be, it could be a story about, a kind of folklore story, but it could also be have more kind of ideologically tinged meanings, such as an allegory about the Japanese Empire. And this is something that I explore by looking at different writings about Momotaro. In some way, allegory is part of every chapter in this book. So it's a kind of method of reading, I think. And it's to look for another level of meaning behind the surface level of the text. Just as Freud looked at dreams and found latent meanings, I think I'm looking for latent meanings of colonial literature, which can deepen our understanding of them.
Thank you. And yeah, it's really, it does come through in throughout your book. So thank you for laying that out in the introduction. Now, staying with the introduction, you also discussed the idea of the Japanese Empire being different to yet mimetic of Western imperialism and describe it as an interstitial empire. Could you expand on your conceptualization of the Japanese Empire as well as discuss the significance of the concept of mimicry in your book?
Yes. I think when we talk about modern Japan, we're really dealing with this a big break with Japan's past because of this intrusion of Western imperialism. And Japan is, it's opened up. We speak of the opening of Japan, the crisis of Japan, the Meiji Restoration. So there's a kind of violent and sudden break in the way that the Japanese, Japanese history. I'm a modernist, so that means that I'm primarily concerned with the modern period of Japanese history. But almost always when we refer to modern Japan, we're talking about Japan as in some way westernizing or modernizing. This is where the mimetic aspect of the Japanese Empire comes in. I think that there's this is something that's not just relevant to Japan as an empire, but relevant to Japan in general. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that Japan, although it's not colonized, it is in this treaty port system, which was also applied to China after the Opium War. Japan is, subject to extraterritorial judges, to the application of Western law in their own country, no freedom to set its own tariffs. All these policies are imposed upon Japan. Although Japan is not formally made into a colony, this does account for a certain some aspects of what will later become the Japanese Empire. That and also the other thing I would say is that the sense of Japan as an Asian country in a world dominated by Western countries, and the racism that Japanese discover overseas. It's not saying that there's no racism in Japan. There certainly is. But there's Japan in the early 20s and during that period between the two wars does, in fact, confront examples of American and European racism, particularly during the Versailles Treaty negotiations. This is, I guess, where the interstitial idea comes, that Japan is somehow between Western empires and the Asian countries that it wants to colonize. It's, in some ways, it's closer to them. And this is also influencing the rhetoric of the Japanese Empire, which often posits a kind of similarity between colonizer and colonized. And I think this is something quite different from, let's say, Said's idea of Orientalism.
Thank you. No, that was really helpful. And I think the ambivalence that comes through in the rest of your chapter sort of, is captured by the interstitial empire, the idea of it being sort of in the middle somewhere. Mm. So in chapter one, you talk about the Japanese colonization of Taiwan and focus on the trope of the savage Aboriginal headhunter. And these are all obviously scare quotes. Yes. Interestingly, you argue that in that post-30s, 1930s Japanese colonial writings not only reflected a growing disillusionment with capitalist modernity, they also illustrate a shift from the, quote, rhetoric of domination, end quote, to a rhetoric of desire. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what you mean by this and how it relates to colonial writing on Aborigines in Taiwan and Japanese occupation there more generally?
Yes, I think, it's interesting that Taiwan is a very complicated island, and it was colonized by a number of different powers, and Japan, it also colonized Taiwan for a longer period of time than the other areas of the Japanese Empire from 1895 to the end of the Second World War. So it's 50 years. And so you can see some interesting things going on. You can see an evolution, you can see changes. And I guess that's what I'm positing in this chapter, that there's a kind of, at first, actually when Japan colonized Taiwan at first, the opposition was the Han Chinese population, which mm-hmm. rebelled against the Japanese invasion of the island. If anything, the Aborigines, who were more in the center of Taiwan, were seen as potential allies to be won over. At some point, this changes when Japan decides to take over the resources the mountainous part of Taiwan, and particularly camphor at this time. That was a major product in the world market. So at that point, then the rhetoric becomes that these people are headhunters, they're savages, and Japan sees itself as a civilizer. This is something that you see in the, I guess you'd call them narratives of conquest in the early part of the empire. But later on, and this is quite interesting because there is a very huge rebellion against the Japanese in 1930, known as the Musha Rebellion, in which Aboriginal belonging to one group attack a kind of sports day and massacre more than 100 Japanese. This is, but it's after this event. Now that there is a military response to this, Japan really takes over. Eliminates the rebellion, kills hundreds of people, and so forth. But there's also a kind of shift in, to something more like the noble savage rhetoric, that these people are seen as somehow perhaps doomed, but as noble. And they are noble because they're natural. A lot of writers, and in this respect, I think there's a lot of similarity with, stories by D.H. Lawrence or other Western writers, that this attempt to return to the body, to the physical life, to the kind of nature, to the reality of desire, and leave behind our artificial industrial civilization. This is something we see in Japanese, and for that reason, the savage takes on this more positive meaning. And this is something we see in particularly the literature on Taiwan. I look at the story by Oshika Taku, and it's called actually The Savage, Yabanjin. And in that story, we can see a Japanese who is sort of wanting to become a savage. And so this is something that we can see in late colonial discourse. And I'd say this shift is taking place because of change, you know, the growth of a capitalist economy, a consumer economy in Japan, a shift that's taking place in the island, events like the Musha incident and so forth. There's a rather big shift that's taking place in the period when Japan rules Taiwan, and one of it concerns this figure of the savage, I think.
That's great. Thank you. I really enjoyed that chapter and that discussion. Thank you so much. So in chapter two, you explore the work of Sato Haruo and demonstrate the influence of Japanese colonial anthropology on his writings. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on this through describing your analysis of Macho or Demon Bird as an allegory about the massacre of Koreans in the aftermath of the Great Kanto earthquake? You discussed this a little bit earlier, but I was wondering if you could expand on it.
Sure. Well, Sato Haruo is an interesting writer, and he actually wrote a lot of works based on his experiences traveling to Taiwan. I think it was around 1920, if I can recall correctly. And he spent a few months in Taiwan, but then later, over the next period of maybe 10 or 15 years, he wrote perhaps a dozen works, which are sort of were fertilized by that that trip to Taiwan. And while he was in Taiwan, he was befriended by an anthropologist by the name of Mori Uchinosuke, who lived in Taiwan for a long time, and had written a lot about the different customs of Aboriginal groups in Taiwan. So he was. This is one thing that I sort of posit in my reading of Macho, that in some ways the narrator of that story adopts a kind of anthropological view of of the Aboriginal people, and identifies himself in some ways with the ethnographer. And in fact, the story of the demon bird, this bird that if you see it, you will die. And there are people that can control these birds who are sort of persecuted. So this story itself actually does come from a passage in a work by Mori Uchinosuke, which I discovered, and this sort of changed my thinking about this story. The other thing that changed my thinking about the story was the actual place. This story was published for the first time in Chuo Koron, right after the Great Kanto earthquake. I believe it was the Great Kanto earthquake took place in September 1923, and I think it was like the next month. So when the printing presses started running again, he published this story. And a lot of what's in the story, although he doesn't make any reference whatsoever to the massacre of Koreans in the Great Kanto earthquake, almost everything that's in this story is sort of about this notion of finding a scapegoat and persecuting them. And so it seems to fit this story that rather than write about the Koreans, he's writing about the Koreans through an allegory. He's writing about them through this discussion of this primitive custom in an Aboriginal group that he read about in an anthropological work. So I guess the argument is partly this is an allegory, and partly it is a kind of anthropological analysis of this custom and an attempt to make sense of it. And I guess also a criticism of the Japanese Empire. And I think I sort of came upon this interpretation by really trying to figure out what this story was about. So it took me some time to kind of put together what the story actually was talking about. I mean, I remember I read it in an anthology of colonial period literature. This came out about 20 years ago, and it seemed like a very interesting story, but I didn't realize what the story actually meant until a long time afterwards, after doing research.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's a really, really interesting reading of that text. Thank you so much. Now, in chapter 3, you shift your focus to Japanese colonial rule in the South Seas and explore Japan's famous folktale, Momotaro. Mm-hmm. Could you give the listeners a brief overview of the story of Momotaro for those who are not familiar with the story, and talk about how it became an allegory with shifting and polyvalent meanings for Japanese colonial interests and rule in the South Seas?
Okay, so Momotaro is... I believe when it was first translated into English, which I think took place in early in the Meiji period, it is the story of peach boys. So it's a boy who is born from a peach, and this peach is floating down the river, and an old childless couple fish it out of the river, and inside they discover a young boy who grows into a very strong young boy, and decides that he will conquer the island of the ogres, and sets off to conquer them and bring back their treasures with three animal retainers. There's a dog, a monkey, and a pheasant. So these are the three retainers of Momotaro. And so this story that has existed for a number of centuries, but during the colonial period, and this is an interesting thing in Japan, you know, there is a period, I guess, before the Edo period, when there are Japanese communities, trading communities, there's Japanese pirates living outside Japan, forming communities in Southeast Asia, for example. But over most of the course of Japanese history, the Japanese are, you know, there's not a lot of heroic figures who are sort of prefigure the Japanese colonial period. And I think it's partly for this reason that Momotaro is seen as somehow expressing this, the Japanese desire to go beyond Japan, to go to other places and take them over or bring back their treasures. And for this reason, I think it becomes an allegory about the Japanese Empire. And there are specific figures. I mentioned in particular Nitobe, Inazo, who is an important figure in many different ways in Japan, in modern Japan, as a but his actual his academic discipline was sort of colonial development, there was a chair of colonial development in major Japanese universities such as Tokyo University. And he was, in fact, the first titular professor of this discipline. Now, in the post-war period, these become sort of the chair of economic development. But it's called colonial development or colonial policy in this earlier period. And he, in fact, is the first to kind of describe the Japanese Momotaro Shugi, this ideology of Momotaro, that this is in some ways expressing some deep aspect of Japanese culture and the sort of irrepressible urge of the Japanese to expand. And he explicitly ties it to expanding to the south. Now, there's no location of the Isle of the Ogres, of course. But for that reason, it's kind of a plastic concept that can be applied to almost anything. And I think that's what is taking place in the story. He situates it as this Momotaro expresses the Japanese urge to go to the south and to take over the tropical products in the south. And other writers after him develop this idea and even turn it into a parody of the Japanese Empire. So this becomes, again, a trope that's used throughout the colonial period to talk about the Japanese Empire. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed that chapter. Having heard about Momotaro, but hadn't, you know, heard this reading or this sort of interpretation of it before. So I was wondering if you could read a short excerpt from the next chapter, chapter 4, of your book, and expand on your analysis of Nakajima's writings.
Okay, so I'll read this. In my study of Nakajima Atsushi, I argue that this writer appropriated, Western tinted glasses and used them quite deliberately and self-consciously to situate himself within a Japanese empire. By looking at his colonial fiction, we discover that he was complex, a writer who had ambivalent feelings about his own place, about Europe and the South Seas, and about the Japanese empire he both faithfully served and grew disillusioned with. By looking closely at the narrator's perspective in Nakajima's fiction, I shed light on the ambivalences and aporia that characterize the Japanese colonial gaze at the end of the colonial period. When I started to write my dissertation, I was thinking to just study the work of Nakajima Atsushi, a writer I became quite interested in, and I translated some of his fiction.
Interesting.
He died quite young. He died in 1942, I believe, maybe about 30 years old. And he grew up in colonial Korea. His father had a job there. He went to a school there, I think a middle school. And then toward the he visited China and wrote a lot of his stories set in ancient China. And then toward the end of his life, he wrote two books that I was quite interested in. One of them was a kind of fictional autobiography of Robert Louis Stevenson. So he had this kind of identification with Stevenson. And in fact, he liked Stevenson. He suffered from lung problems. He died quite young. And I think he saw Stevenson as a kind of romantic figure. But one of the things that probably really interested him was Stevenson's writings about the South Seas. And so he writes this biography, and then he himself quits his job in Yokohama and goes to Japanese-ruled Micronesia and lives in Palau until the start of the Second World War. And then he goes back to Japan, publishes some of these works, and dies in 1942. So this, I guess this idea of Western tinted glasses is that, when we think of modern Japanese literature, we often are going to think of things like, the theater, the modern poetry, the novel, short stories. We're thinking of essentially Western forms that are adopted by Japanese. And another thing that's adopted by Japanese is this idea of looking at the world through kind of Western glasses. And this is clearly the case Nakajima Atsushi. One of the reasons he sees the South Seas as so interesting and so exotic is because he's very interested in writers like Pierre Loti, Robert Louis Stevenson, Melville, or Gauguin. All of these figures that are in Western culture, they've created this the South Seas marvelous, I guess. And so he identifies with this, but at the same time, and this is one of the interesting things in his fiction, he sort of can detach himself from this fascination and step back and say, this is inauthentic. I'm not really looking at these people. I'm not really looking at the... And he does this in one of his stories. And I think when we read his stories, we can kind of see he's trying to figure out his own place as a Japanese imperialist, as a Japanese colonial official, which he was when he was in Palau, and situating himself with regard to both Europe and the South Seas. And so I guess for that reason, he was kind of a fascinating figure for me. That was why I was sort of interested in just focusing on Nakajima Atsushi at the beginning. But in the end, I sort of just made, he was sort of late in the Japanese Empire. And I guess I made it for that reason. I made him the last major chapter of my book. that mm-hmm. he was the other periods, like Sato Haruo was sort of in the Taisho period, a kind of liberal interlude in the Japanese Empire. And then the first chapter is looking sort of at the earlier period, the conquest of the mountainous parts of Taiwan. So this mm-hmm. is late Empire, I guess.
I just had a quick sort of follow-up question. You know, reading this chapter and the other chapters as well, you know, you talk, you know, about the ambivalent feelings and sort of feelings of uncomfortableness or doubt. Do you think there's a, you know, guilt is not a word I heard, I read, I don't remember reading, but I was thinking, you know, is guilt one of the ways you can sort of think about how they were, you know, thinking about the Japanese Empire and what it was doing on the ground?
Yeah, I think there was definitely guilt, feeling that they were doing something atrocious, particularly in the case of, you know, Nakajima Atsushi. He was sent there at a time when they were trying to, I think, change the educational system to make people identify more closely with the Japanese Empire. This has been studied much more probably in relation to Taiwan or Korea, especially, but mm-hmm. this was these late imperial policies. This was actually what he was working in, a kind of in the school system to create better textbooks to teach Japanese language, and so I think he did feel some guilt, and also that you know, terrible things were going on in mm-hmm. in the Japanese Empire. So I guess, yes, there was some guilt in him and other writers too.
Great, thank you. It definitely came through in this chapter in particular for some reason, but I think, yeah, it probably was there in others too. So now in the conclusion, you look at continuities and ruptures of the trope of savagery in post-war Japanese writings, this time through novels that feature cannibalism. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about how, while the trope of savagery continued, it took a very different form in the post-war period in the context of the Japanese defeat in the Second World War and the ensuing Cold War?
Yes, I stopped this sort of fairly early in the post-war period, and at one point I almost intended to write a second sequel. Which would look at the later development of this theme of savagery, or how this, you know, kind of develops into a consumer culture stressing tourism to the tropics. However, I never did that, and instead I looked at this sort of brief period after the war, when there are a number of writers who are looking at the theme of cannibalism. And this is in some of the post-war novels, for example, Fires on the Plain, which sort of reads as an anti-war novel, but it mm-hmm. definitely features cannibalism. And partly I think this is because, you know, at the end of the war, the soldiers sort of abandoned on these islands, such as the Philippines or Papua New Guinea, had no supplies, no food, nothing. And there were cases of cannibalism, and this has been studied in different contexts. But in this case, it's the Japanese who are the cannibals, rather than the savage other. And mm-hmm. so I think that in some ways, this is a continuation of this theme of the savage, but this is definitely combined with war guilt. So this feeling of remorse for what mm-hmm. what had happened during the war is expressed through the trope of the cannibal.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, in the pre-war or pre-45 period, what is sort of hinted at is much more upfront in the post-war context.
Yeah, and it's no longer this kind of way of talking about yourself. We're talking about other people. It's looking, you know, particularly in Fires on the Plain. It's looking at the experience of Japanese soldiers, and mm-hmm. There are other accounts of this too. And this has been also you know, this has been in movies. I'm thinking in particular of what's the, I can't remember the name of the movie now, but the emperor's imperial army marches on or something. There's something about it's a documentary movie about a Japanese later, I think it's in the 70s or 80s, who goes mm-hmm. after kind of officers in the army at this time. And in fact, what he discovers is this kind of cannibalism. And this is actually a documentary movie mm-hmm. that came out, I think, in the late 70s, I believe. But in any case, this is a topic that has been explored and continues to be written about, you know, long after the war.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. So before we end our discussion on your book, I was just wondering if you had any general thoughts about the relationship between the fields of history and comparative literature. I recognize these, you know, fields are the boundaries are a lot more porous, and there's a lot of sort of borrowings. And for instance, thinking, you know, with Tropics of Savagery, can engaging more with literature help us ask questions about intellectual and political cultures of empires or, you know, other political forms in ways that maybe other historical texts can't?
Yes. I mean, I think that that this book, although it is primarily an intervention in the field of literature, and the main texts that I look at are literary, I also, I have a kind of cultural studies approach to this that I'm looking at this literature as a type of writing with connections with all the other discourses that are going on at the same time. So, mm-hmm. For that reason, I think for example, in the chapter on Sato Haruo, I look at the beginning of Japanese anthropology, and then I try to relate it to that story. In Momotaro, I'm looking at folklore, and in almost every chapter, I'm trying to trace the history of something and show how it was inflected by imperialism. So I would say that the connection between literature and history is, for me, I think it's inevitable that if you're studying literary text, you we'll also think about the time that it appeared, its relationship to its own period, the society of its time, and so forth. And this is something that I'm definitely doing. So I do mm-hmm. consider myself then someone who has a historical approach to literature.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in some ways, if I didn't know you were a literary scholar, this could easily be, you know, a type of intellectual history or something in that vein. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I know, but I really...
This is the direction that I've sort of gone in my next book, which I'll talk about maybe some other time.
Yes.
I think that this, it's also, it's more implicit maybe in my book, Tropics of Savagery. The other, the comparative aspect, I mean, although I'm not so much... drawing a specific comparison between Japanese imperial literature and some other imperial literature, I think I'm trying to put it in the subtitle is in a comparative frame. I'm looking at it as an example of this imperial literature, which has its own maybe unique qualities, but is also has lots of common elements with other imperial literatures. So, and I think that provides the basis of comparison.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So I've taken so much of your time, but before I let you go, could you tell us about your current project? And before you answer that question, I think you've already mentioned this. I just want to tell the listeners that we will be discussing the book you did after this, Monster of 20th Century, published in 2015, later this year.
Yes. Actually, I've been working on a couple of projects. One of them having to do more with medical humanities, broadly defined. I'm concerned with writings of Japanese writers who know that they're dying and how they write about death. And so that's one project that I'm looking
Fascinating.
At. And another one is this Monster of the 20th Century is actually includes a translation of Kotoku Shusui. I'm interested in his teacher, Nakai Chomin, who translated Rousseau, the social contract, into Japanese. And recently I've been working on that translation, trying to understand, first of all, is it a translation? And then what does it do to Rousseau? How do you create a Japanese idea of democracy? So these are some of the things that I've been working on recently. Actually, I'm working on the Nakai Chomin as we speak. This is this semester I'm on leave, and so I've been working on that project.
Really look forward to reading that as well when it comes out. And for listeners who are interested, I remember listening to an interview that you had on that project on Meiji at 150 podcast. So if listeners are interested, they should they can find that on any of the app stores or the podcast apps. Okay. Thank you so much.